This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So welcome everyone to the UCSF Mini Medical School. I'm Terry Friedlander, I'm a medical oncologist. I recognize a few faces from last week and there's some new ones today. I'm going to be talking about testis cancer today, or testicular cancer. I'm going to talk about a few different things. First, we're just going to talk about how the testis forms, how it sort of normally functions. Then really move on to like what is testicular cancer or germ cell tumors. Then we're going to talk about how patients present, how we work them up. And then I'm going to focus on sort of localized disease or disease that's just in the testis. Then discuss what happens when the cancer leaves the testis. And lastly, finish up with what happens when it comes back despite our treatments and some of the new sort of directions in the field. So this is a picture of an embryo. This is a very early embryo. This is probably at maybe 2 or 3 weeks after conception. And what you see is basically the head over here and the sort of tail or the what would eventually become the feet down here. This is the placenta, which is where the embryo gets all its nutrients from. And the reason I show this is because in the very center of the body of the embryo, starting as early as 3 weeks, there's something called the gonadal ridge that forms. And this is basically where the testes form. So they form very, very early, and they form right in the center of the body. And this picture also shows the germ cells, which are these little sort of blue dots here, or purple dots. And the germ cells essentially sort of start out in the embryo. They migrate through some of the tissues here, but they eventually all localize or hone in on this gonadal ridge. And they sort of fill that area in, and they'll fill in the testes. And eventually, when the testes mature and the baby's born and then, you know, grows up, these are the cells that are going to turn into sperm. And this is very important because in testicular cancer, these are the cells that also eventually turn into cancer. And I'll explain more about this, but I want to just sort of emphasize that these all originate in the center of the body, and that has very important implications for how testicular cancer spreads. And you'll see that in just a little bit. Please stop me if you have any questions. So this is sort of the development after the first few weeks of growth. So at 2 months, the testes have already sort of formed. They've sort of gone to either side of the body, and they've started to descend. So there are these big white things here. And you can see here's the stomach, and this is sort of the intestine in the developing fetus. Again, this is a fetus that would only be maybe a few inches long. But you can already see that the testes are forming. At about 4 months, they look a little bit more like testicles, but they're still sort of inside the abdomen. They're in the center of the body. They're not down in the scrotum where they are in the adult. And this is essentially right at birth, where you can see here, it doesn't project very well, but you can see that in blue down here is the testis, and you can see that it's actually descended all the way from this location up near where the kidneys were in the center of the body, all the way down into the scrotum. And that's the normal descent. And for those of you who have kids, or for the men in there who remember being a child, the doctor would always check to make sure that a baby's testes have descended. And if they haven't descended by a few months after birth, that's a problem because they can get stuck higher up. And I'll talk a little bit more about why that's a problem. But this is the normal development. And what's really important to remember is that the blood supply to these testes comes from way up here in the center of the belly. And as they descend down into the scrotum, they drag that blood supply with them. And that, again, is really important when we think about how testis cancer spreads, because it'll follow this same path and spread up into the abdomen. And you'll see that in just a little bit. Questions so far?
No. Is that why some people seem only to have one testis?
Yeah, some people have one testis because this one does, the other one doesn't form, or it only sort of forms very preliminarily. And when the doctor notices that it's not there, they very frequently will do surgery to try and find it and either pull it down if it's healthy or just remove it. But you're right. Sometimes when people only are born with one testicle, it's because one of these had a problem. So what do the testes do? And I think this is maybe very obvious, but they're very distinct roles. There are two major functions that the testes serve in a man. And the first one is to make sperm. So here's a picture of a sperm fertilizing an egg. And the other one is to make testosterone. And testosterone is a male hormone that sort of makes men men. So here's a picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is full of testosterone, probably that he bought from somebody online. But they're very different functions. And you'll see what I mean in a little bit. The sperm come from the germ cells. And I already showed you a picture of what some of these germ cells sort of look like. Whereas the testosterone is actually made by different cells in the testes. So they're very biologically distinct. And they go by the names of the discoverers, which were Sertoli and Leydig, who lived about 100, 150 years ago. So this is the anatomy of a testicle if you just had bisected it. And what you see is basically that it's sort of surrounded by a sort of a sheath, more or less. And inside the sheath are these septations or these divisions. And inside each one of these are these tubules. And the tubules are sort of all coiled up into these different sections. What happens is the sperm, as you're going to see in a few more slides, are made inside these sort of tubules right at the edge, right around here. And then they progress and they sort of mature through the tubules and they eventually come out this tube called the vas deferens and they go off to sort of the join up with the rest of the anatomy in the human. Questions about this? What I'm going to do is zoom in a little bit on how this works. So imagine we took this section and just blew it up under a microscope. So this is what you're seeing now. This last section here is now blown up here where this is the sort of sheath that I was talking about that wraps around the testis. And then these are these tubules or these that you were seeing on the last slide sort of cut in cross sections. So it's almost like you're looking down, as though you're looking down a noodle or, you know, penne or something. And what you can see is that the testes, these tubules are sort of lined with these layers of cells. It's almost similar to our skin, the way there's layers of cells, you know, if you really drill in on it. And as we'll see in a sec, the sperm are sort of born back here at the very edge of these tubules, and they actually grow up kind of going down through or sort of as they move towards the center of these tubules. And then when they're ready and they're ready to sort of mature and they're ready to go, they kind of fall off into the tubule, and then they sort of swim off, hopefully to fertilize an egg at some point. Questions? No. So I'm going to drill in a little more, just like I did before, on what one of these looks like if you look really close. And so this is one tubule, and what you can see here are the different cells that I talked about. So first you can see down here are what are called the spermatocytes, which are like the most primitive germ cells. And they don't look like sperm, right? They just look like round cells, and they're very big compared to the size of a sperm. And I'll show you in just the next slide sort of how these develop. But there are other cells in here, like the Sertoli cells that I just mentioned and the Leydig cells. These Sertoli cells are also called nurse cells because literally the sperm sort of grow up literally through the Sertoli cells, and the Sertoli cells kind of bathe them and nurture them to keep them more or less happy, so they develop normally. The Leydig cells kind of sit outside the tubules, and these are the ones that make testosterone. And they're sort of less related to the sperm than the Sertoli cells are. So this is a picture of a Sertoli cell. We just drilled in on one of them. And the Sertoli cell is this whole big green area. And what you see at the bottom here is what's called the spermatogonium, which is the most primitive type of germ cell. And what happens is as these sort of grow up and develop, they start dividing. And they'll divide into what are called spermatocytes, sort of different types of spermatocytes. They form eventually into spermatids. And then these spermatids grow these little tails. And they form into mature sperm. When we talk about testis cancer, as you're going to see, we're talking about a cancer of these cells, of these very primitive cells that are sort of should become sperm, but just are unable to, and that causes a lot of trouble. Questions? So this is sort of the normal development. This is basically very similar to what I just showed you on the last slide, where this is the most primitive germ cell up top. And as these cells sort of divide, they duplicate their DNA. That's not so important for the purpose of this talk. These cells then divide and they split and they essentially form these more mature cells and then they grow these little tails. And all that's left is basically a tail, some machinery for swimming and energy, and the DNA, which is obviously important for making a baby. So this is normal development. What happens in germ cell tumors is that there's some kind of damage to this initial cell, and there's a lot of hypotheses about what it is that causes testis cancer. And the truth is, we still don't know in every case for sure what caused it. But instead of growing up in that normal way and dividing and becoming these sort of mature sperm, what happens is these cells just start dividing and literally making copies of themselves. And what you get is essentially a big mass of all of these same cells. They sort of look like clones in a lot of cases. And they sort of are just dividing, and they don't really have any, there's no control over their division. And so that's really what makes a tumor or a germ cell tumor. Does that make sense? Any questions? Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit more about how that happens. This is a picture. This is a really useful picture when we're thinking about testis cancer, because this is a tumor that was removed. The entire testis was removed from the patient, and the pathologist sliced right into the tumor and then stained it and then imaged it under a microscope. And so this is all one section. It's not two slides. And this, what you can see, is the normal tubules, which I was just showing you. And right next to it is the cancer. And you can see clearly that these normal tubules have all these different sizes of cells, and they're sort of growing up normally as they become mature sperm into the center of these tubules. Whereas here, you can sort of imagine that there was a tubule here at one point, but it's filled with essentially these really homogeneous-looking cells. And if you look at the center, their nuclei are really big, which is a hallmark of cancer, and it's like totally dysregulated. And so this is really, when we think of cancer, this is what the pathologist is looking for under the microscope. So this is germ cell tumor. And I said that, you know, there are other types of cells in the testis, like the Sertoli and the Leydig cells. So there are other types of cancer that can form in the testis beyond germ cell tumors. And these are really rare. Like, we see maybe one or two of these per year. So when I'm, for most of the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus on germ cell tumors, which are probably 95 to 98% of what patients have and what we're dealing with in the clinic. Rarely people can get cancers of the Sertoli or the Leydig cells, these endocrine or hormone-producing cells. And they can either make a lot of testosterone and men develop sort of like, they look like they're on steroids, or they can make estrogen. And when a man has an estrogen-producing tumor, they can develop large breasts just like a woman would. And they develop all these feminizing features. And so maybe 3-4 years ago, we saw a patient who had an estrogen-producing tumor. And this is not him, but this was basically his complaint, was he went to his doctor and he said, my chest has gotten really big. And when they sort of did an exam, they felt a little nodule on his testis. And when they biopsied it, lo and behold, it was a Sertoli cell tumor. When they removed his testis, that affected testis, his breast sort of went back to normal. So it's a very clear kind of proof of concept there. These other types of tumors can form in the testes. Again, really rare. Sarcomas are sort of soft tissue tumors. They usually happen in like the legs or the arms. They can happen in bone or cartilage. So rarely they can sort of form in the testis. We don't really know why. And then lymphomas are cancers of the immune system. And so lymphomas can happen anywhere in the body. They generally develop in lymph nodes. And so the immune cells in the testis sometimes can become cancerous and grow in the testis. And if it's a lymphoma of the testis, it's treated as though it was a lymphoma sort of anywhere else in the body. And that's very different treatment than how we treat germ cell tumors. Okay. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the numbers of germ cell tumors. So there are about 8,000 cases per year, which makes it, I forget the exact number, it's like the 9th or 10th most common cancer. So it's not terribly common. The good news is that there are only about 500 deaths per year in the U.S. If you look at a disease like pancreas cancer, there are almost as many deaths as there are cases because it's such a bad disease. And you can see from this, you know, about 90% of people who get testis cancer, more than 90% are cured of it long term. So that's a really good thing. And it's a nice field to be in because most patients come in extremely nervous, as you might expect, but you can actually offer really curative therapy. I said testis cancer is not that common overall, but in young men, it's the most common cancer. So if a young man has cancer, it's a lot, most likely to be testis cancer. There's a finding that it's more common in Caucasians than it is in African Americans. It's more common in Western cultures than it is in Eastern cultures. And whether that's due to environment or genetics or some kind of interaction, I think we're still trying to figure out. I'll say a little bit more about the genetics in just a second. And again, it's highly curable. And that's even in the presence of distant disease. So most cancers, once they become metastatic, like bladder cancer we talked about last week, we don't really have the tools to cure metastatic bladder cancer. There's new therapies, new investigational treatments. But testis cancer, even when it's widespread, is still curable. And probably the best example of that is Lance Armstrong, who had testis cancer. It started in his testis and spread all the way to his brain. And he had a tumor in his brain that was testicular cancer. And with a combination of chemotherapy and surgery, he was rendered disease-free. He's been, like, disease-free for over 10 years, which is means he's very likely cured. And so this is also sort of good news when patients come in, even with metastatic disease. The cure rates have really, really improved. And this is the one example in, not maybe not the one, but probably the best example in oncology of a chemosensitive disease, meaning that chemotherapy is what's really responsible for the sort of improvement in cure rates from only about 60% in the 1960s, where it was really a bad disease for a lot of men, to greater than 90% nowadays. So there's been a lot of research, or at least a fair amount of research, looking at why people develop cancer, testis cancer specifically. And there are really three risk factors that we know of. The first one is the undescended testis, which I'm going to say a little bit more about. Second one is a family history. So if a father or a brother has testis cancer, then a male family member is more likely to get it. And for men who've already had testis cancer on one side, they're at much higher risk of developing it on the other side, which really argues that there's some kind of genetic basis, some inborn genetic basis for this cancer. The other thing that argues for that is that it happens in young men. Most cancers that occur in people who are over the age of 60 or 70, and that's because they've maybe smoked cigarettes for 50 years or been exposed to some kind of toxin. Most young men have not been exposed to years and years of really, really, you know, carcinogenic toxins. So it would make sense that there's some genetic component to testis cancer. There are probably a lot more causes or risk factors that we still, even today, even though we know so much about this disease, we still don't recognize. I'll say a little bit more about this in a subsequent slide. So what are undescended testes? I sort of brought this up at the beginning. You know, it's a failure of the testicular, the normal testis to kind of move down into the scrotum. It's probably due to some kind of inborn problem in that testis. It would make sense. As opposed to some sort of external problem. And the thought, and this is not really well proven, is that there's some genetic instability in that testis that's caused it to develop abnormally and move abnormally. And that sort of genetic instability kind of progresses over the course of a man's life, and when he's 20 or 25 or 30, it finally leads to the development of a cancer. But there's still a lot to be discovered or learned about this. The family risk, for undescended testes, the risk is 10 to 50 times as high as a patient who doesn't have an undescended testis. This is the reason why the pediatricians are so tuned into this, because they want to essentially remove that testis, which can lower the risk of developing testis cancer. It doesn't completely eliminate the risk, because even men who've had their undescended testis removed can develop testicular cancer in the normal testis. Again, arguing that there's some sort of genetic basis for this cancer.
If you remove that one testis, does that impact the potency?
Does removing one testicle impact potency or libido? No, most men, the other testis can sort of take over and become sort of provide enough testosterone and enough sperm that they can live essentially normal lives. It's a problem, and when I just said before, that patients who have testis cancer are at risk of developing it on the other side. Because if they're, say, they're 20 years old when they have their first one, and then they're 29 when they have their second one, if the second tumor is big enough that the whole testicle needs to come out, then suddenly you have a 29-year-old man who's got no testes. So it's his fertility is essentially lost, unless he's banked sperm in advance. And his ability to make testosterone is essentially lost. And so these men end up on either patches or injections for lifelong testosterone supplementation. So there's a lot of, I mean, for me, it's very interesting treating these patients because it's not just thinking about how am I going to cure this person, but it's how am I going to cure them and preserve their fertility and preserve their hormone status and, you know, do it in as in with the least amount of harm, you know, because I said it's a very treatable cancer. We want to, like, sort of not over-treat people who don't need it. And I'll talk about that, too, in a subsequent slide. Other questions? So I'm going to talk a little bit about the genetic risk factors. So this is called a karyotype. This is essentially one cell, a normal cell from a person. If you were to blow up the cell a lot, take the nucleus out of it, and literally take the chromosomes out. And so this is all of the DNA, all of the genetic material in one cell. And these are the different chromosomes. In humans, we have, it's actually cut off here, but we have 23 chromosomes. And they essentially go from biggest to smallest. That's how they're numbered. And you get one chromosome from mom and one chromosome from dad. And so for each chromosome, we have two copies. And that's what leads to sort of evolution and our genetic, you know, sort of all the differences between us. Normally, when a cell divides, it has to make exact copies of each one of these to sort of function normally. And if it doesn't, the cells almost always die. And, for example, in embryos, if they develop an extra chromosome, that can lead to a number of genetic problems. Most embryos that have extra chromosomes don't survive because it causes so much havoc in a cell or in a fetus. When we have an extra copy of chromosome 21, which you don't see down here, but essentially looks like all the others, that causes Down syndrome. So in men with testis cancer, we see something very commonly on chromosome 12, which is that the top half of this chromosome somehow breaks apart and duplicates itself. So men have essentially an extra copy, it's actually two extra copies of the top part of this chromosome. So they have essentially much more, they have a sort of increased number of genes in these tumors that are coming from chromosome 12. And this is called, there's a name for it, it's called isochrome 12P. And this is sort of a schematic of it, where this is, over here, is the normal chromosome on the left. Let's see if this projects. And where you have a top part to the chromosome and a bottom part to the chromosome. And what happens is there's a failure of this bottom part to duplicate, and you instead get a mirror image. This is sort of the top part with duplicated, and you have a mirror image of the top part here on the right. And so essentially, I don't want to get too lost in the genetics of it, but these patients have extra copies of chromosome 12, of genetic material on chromosome 12, in their tumors. This is not in their germline. This is just when they look in the tumor. And so the thought is that somehow, this occurs in about 50% or more of testis cancers, that there's probably some genes on here that contribute or sort of help to the development of testis cancer. Okay. So this is a little complicated, but the take-home point is that there's abnormalities in the chromosomes in the tumor that probably predispose the germ cell to becoming cancerous. There are other studies that have looked at chromosome X, which is the chromosome we get from our generally from our mother. This is a picture of chromosome X and chromosome Y in a human. And there have been studies where they looked at hundreds or even thousands of patients, some who had testis cancer and some who didn't. And what they saw was that there was a sort of locus or an area on chromosome X that patients who developed testis cancer seemed to share, meaning that there may be some inherited, and this is what I was getting at earlier, some inherited susceptibility to testis cancer. There have been a few studies looking at this, and they're a little contradictory, but the weight of the evidence seems to favor that there may be something in this area on chromosome X that's predisposing these families to developing testis cancer. There's also a disease called Klinefelter syndrome, where patients get an extra X chromosome, so they're XXY. And they also develop germ cell tumors actually outside the testis as well. So there's something going on X that we don't completely understand. So I'm going to shift a little bit to talk about how patients present when they come in the door, what's going on. And, you know, the most common presentation is really just a painless mass in the testis. Most patients, like, sort of feel this when they're in the shower or when they're doing an exam at any point. And what they're feeling is this little tumor that's formed on the side of their testis. And the, I mean, the good news for testis cancer is it's very sort of external to the body, so it's a very easy cancer to detect just by using a self-exam. Rarely, if the cancer spread, and it'll spread to the belly that I showed you, the area I showed you before, patients will complain of back pain, and then someone will do an exam and find the tumor. Remember, testis cancer occurs mostly in young men. And I'll be sort of like glib with some of the patients, but, you know, I'll tell them to their, you know, sort of straight up. I'll say, you know, young men get testis cancer. Young men are not that smart, you know. Young men sort of don't always run to the doctor when they notice that there's something wrong. And so that becomes a sort of a challenge in treating young testis cancer patients, because even though they're adults, there's a wide variety of like maturity. And some patients will detect a very small tumor and come straight to see a doctor, and others will let this grow. And I've seen patients who come in with, you know, 10-centimeter gigantic tumors that have already spread. And so that becomes a real challenge in sort of treating patients with testis cancer. So the next step is almost always to do an ultrasound if we feel a tumor in the testis, because there are a number of normal or benign processes that can happen in the testis, like small cysts or small what are called lymphoceles or spermatoceles, which are just little benign collections of fluid in the testis. So this is an ultrasound. The probe is up here at the top, and you're looking sort of deep into the tissue, and what you see is a normal testis here, and it should essentially be really homogeneous, just sort of gray. You can see sort of the rim of the testis here and the fluid in the scrotum. Here's an example of cancer where the cancer is this white thing here, and the cancer has actually caused calcium to form. That's sort of the body's reaction to the tumor, is to make this little bit of calcium. And the calcium blocks the sound waves that are coming from up top here, and it casts a shadow. And so what you'll see on ultrasound is that there's essentially this very large shadow, and sometimes you can actually see, sort of make out the tumor, and they can measure the size of the tumor. So sort of you know what you're dealing with before you go in. So the standard workup is then to do a CT scan to look and see, all right, if it started in the testis, where else is it in the body? And so this is a CT scan. This is a picture of a person with testis cancer, and this is their abdomen. And basically what's going on here is their head is behind the screen, and their feet are sticking out into the audience. And this is the front of their belly, and this is the back of their belly. So we're sort of looking at them from underneath their feet. And what we're looking at is essentially the spine here. Here's a kidney. Here's a kidney. All of this is like intestines. This is the bottom of the liver. And what's really important is that you should only see the aorta, which is this round structure right in the middle of the body. That's the biggest artery in the body. And the vena cava, which is the biggest vein in the body. And those are really the only two structures you should see there. Remember, the testes developed right about this level with the kidney. So as I said before, when testis cancer spreads, it follows that path and will generally deposit right in the belly, in sort of the back part of the belly here. And so what you're going to see as I scroll through this is these little lumps are going to pop up and then sort of vanish. So as we go down here, I'll show you right here. Let me go back up. Right here is the top part of this little lump. And as we go down, you can see it forms this nice sort of circle. And then as you go down a little further, it's gone. So that implies that there's a little lump just sitting there in the person's abdomen. The aorta is still there. The vena cava is still there. There's some very small dots here, which are probably little lymph nodes. But this this one is clearly abnormal, and it's actually bigger than the aorta. So it's probably 2 or 3 centimeters large, which is really not a normal size for a lymph node. I think there's another, and there are other lymph nodes right here in this area that you see pop up. This one's not very big. This one's a little bit bigger. And so this is a very classic presentation of metastatic testis cancer. And you can tell that even before you've done surgery, even before you remove the testis, you can sort of guess that this is going to be a patient who has metastatic testicular cancer, especially if it's a young man. We always look in the belly first because that's where the testes started, that's where their blood supply comes from, and that's the path that they follow. The cancer doesn't have to stay here, though, because the cancer can hop back into the bloodstream and can go up to the chest. And so this is the same view of the chest, where you're seeing the front of the body here, the back of the body here, the vertebrae, and then this is the lungs are in black. Air is essentially black on these scans. And here you can obviously, I mean, this is pretty easy to pick out, see the cancer, which is essentially filling up this this man's lung, like almost the entire lung was full of cancer. And this is obviously a huge problem. And he was someone who had waited, who had had a large testis, but thought that he had damaged it, he had injured it, he had some trauma. And he waited probably 3 or 4 months before coming in. And by the time he'd come in, he had this massive tumor. It became much harder to treat. So there are a lot of...
When the cancer gets into the lung that way, and if you cure the cancer, does the lung get cured?
Yeah, so the answer is if you cure the cancer, what happens to the lung? And what's going on really, you don't see it very well in this picture, is that as the cancer expands, the lung is like a sponge, sort of like a wet sponge, and it'll just give as the cancer expands. And as the cancer shrinks, the lung will sort of pop back into place. So it's very kind of, versatile or kind of plastic in that way. So he actually did well. We actually had to do surgery for him to remove this. It was this massive surgery, and he's now like 3 or 4 years out without any cancer in his body that we can detect. But, you know, huge challenge in doing this management. And he was in the hospital for over a month after, they had to open up a surgery like they were doing a heart surgery. So this was a big deal. So there are a lot of different types of germ cell tumor, and you can get a little bit lost in it because there's so many different subtypes. And initially they were thought to be somewhat different diseases. Truth is that they're all managed in pretty similar ways. So I'm going to try not to get lost in the nitty-gritty details, but there are really five main subtypes of testis cancer. The most common is called seminoma, and it's always described as having a fried egg appearance, which is that the cells are sort of have these little blue nuclei, and then they have a lot of this white cytoplasm, and so they all look like if you sort of really squint, they all kind of look like fried eggs all over the place. This is very common. This is the most common histology, the most common subtype of testis cancer. There are other subtypes. One is called embryonal cell, which are these much sort of clearly different looking cells. There's a type called choriocarcinoma. Choriocarcinoma tends to bleed much more. And so this is a very typical picture where you have these really oddly shaped cells. The nuclei are all very heterogeneous. There are lots of little, what are called nucleoli, or really small areas within the nucleus. And then there's hemorrhage here. So all this red stuff are just red blood cells that have sort of broken into the cancer because the cancer has grown in such a funny way or such a dysregulated way that they bleed. This is a big problem when we see people with metastatic choriocarcinoma, because if it goes to their brain, they're at very high risk of bleeding in the brain. If it goes to the lung, they can bleed into the lung. So we have to be really thoughtful about how we treat these patients and sort of be careful that we don't, just do surgery and cut right into the tumor, because it's one of the most vascular or prone to bleeding tumors. The fourth one is called yolk sac tumor. And if you remember the very first slide I showed you the placenta. These cells are sort of analogous to cells in the placenta. They can form these sort of cystic structures. The last one is probably the most interesting and probably the one that most people have heard about, which is called teratoma. And teratoma is a very unusual type of cancer. It's not that it's rare. It's just that it acts very differently. And the reason it acts differently is teratoma is essentially like mature tissue that develops anywhere in the body, meaning that like we have normal lining of our lungs or lining of our stomach or teeth or hair or cartilage. And teratoma is essentially like a sort of type of cancer that can turn in to all these different types of tissue in the body. And so if you look it up online, you can see pictures where they remove a teratoma and there's literally hairs growing out of it, or there's teeth growing in it, or there's thyroid tissue, or there's muscle. And so this is a picture where you see cartilage up here. You see what looks like lining of the lung in certain parts, and there's lining of other, just totally different types of tissue all sort of growing out of this tumor. It's also sort of considered like a malignant fertilized egg because it sort of has the ability to become anything. It's not it's not limited in what it becomes. And so men can present, I showed you these five different types, men can present with all different combinations of these. And I'll show you why in the next slide. So this is sort of the breakdown. This is how germ cell tumors develop. And so I showed you at the very first slide, there was this primary germ cell tumor, right? The primary spermatocyte, which became malignant and started duplicating itself. And what happens is these cells can start to differentiate. They can start to turn into these different subtypes of tumor. So they're all sort of like related. It's almost like a family tree or an evolutionary tree, where there's probably the very first cell to become malignant develops in one of two directions, and it either becomes seminoma, which was the very first type of tissue I showed you, or it becomes embryonal cell cancer, which was the second type of tissue I showed you. And then the embryonal cell can further differentiate, and some of it can become teratoma as it sort of grows up. You know, even though it's cancer and it's malignant, it's sort of developing. It can become yolk sac, or it can become chorio, which were the other histologies I showed you. And so you could see why one person might come in with 20% this, you know, 15% that, and, you know, the rest teratoma. And we see all different kinds of combinations. The reason why this is important is because for a long time, seminoma was recognized to be a little different than everything else, and it was always treated differently. And teratoma is a little different for reasons I just told you. It can form hair and nails and teeth and all this stuff. And so it's treated a little differently. These other ones are essentially kind of very similar in terms of how sensitive they are to treatment. So we sort of treat them in very similar ways. So again, this is, I'm going to talk a little bit about how we stage the cancers. So once the cancer's formed in the testis, how do we work it up? I sort of mentioned this already. This again is that landing zone we talk about very frequently, which is right between the kidneys. So again, here's a kidney, a normal kidney, aorta, and vena cava. And then there's this lump of stuff in here, which is not normal, which we wouldn't expect, and that's testis cancer. And this is always the first place we're looking to see where the cancer's gone. So stage one testis cancer is confined to the testis only. When we talk about stage one disease, we mean it's only in their testicle. Stage two goes to the back of the belly. The other term for this is retroperitoneum. Peritoneum is the sort of essentially where our guts are in our belly, and retro means behind. So it's that area behind our bowel. And then stage three testis cancer means above the diaphragm, so in the chest, or if it goes actually into organs, like if it goes into the liver, or if it goes to the brain, or if it goes to the lungs, we call that stage three. And there's sort of nuances or differences in how we treat all these types of patients. There's not really a stage four. It's one of the only cancers that doesn't really have a stage four. And that's because the cancer is so treatable in a way that you don't really need to distinguish between stages three and four. Like once it's spread, it's spread, and we sort of treat it the same way. There are some people who think brain disease is stage four disease, but that's a little sort of not set in stone. The other thing that's useful in testis cancer, and it's unique, or I'd say sort of unique to testis cancer, is that we have blood tests that can help us sort of learn or make a diagnosis of testis cancer. And this is very similar to the PSA that we use in prostate cancer, where we can do a blood test, and if we see that the PSA is high, that suggests that there's cancer somewhere in the body. So these blood markers can also tell us that there's testis cancer in the body. And so there's really, there are three markers. I'm going to list two of them here. The first one is called HCG. This is the same thing that's made in women when they become pregnant. It's made by an embryo. And you can see the parallels between testis cancer and almost a fertilized embryo, because they come from the same structures, they're developing in these, you know, obviously totally dysregulated way, but they're developing along somewhat similar lines. So HCG is made by choriocarcinomas and embryonal cell cancers. AFP, which stands for alpha fetoprotein, is also made by developing fetuses, and that's made most commonly by yolk sac tumors and also by embryonal cell here. Teratoma itself doesn't make any markers in the blood. And I didn't show the arrow here, but seminoma can make this HCG as well. The point really is that whenever I see a new patient with testis cancer, this is one of the first things we'll do. Most urologists will do this when they see a patient before they start working the patient up. If the markers are high, for example, if the AFP is high, we know that there's probably yolk sac tumor or embryonal cell tumor in that specimen. And that helps us sort of make the diagnosis. So this is just a sort of a small study where they looked at how long these markers stick around in the body. And HCG lasts for about 24 hours. So you know that if it's up, it's probably there. AFP can last 5 or 7 days, and sometimes it can last longer than that. And so sometimes a man will come in, will have a testis tumor, an elevated AFP, and the testis tumor will be removed by the surgeon. But the AFP will stick around. because that marker that's already, that protein that's already left and is circulating, takes a while to go away. And sometimes we get sort of faked out because we think, oh, the patient's had the testis tumor removed, but the AFP is still elevated. You know, we should give them chemo. There's got to be cancer in their body. When in fact, if you just wait a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you'll see that it sort of declines, you know, right at this pace, and patients actually are, you know, cancer free. There's one more marker that we use called lactate dehydrogenase. This is sort of just a general marker. It's up in a lot of cancers, but it happens to go up in testis cancer as well. And so that can sometimes help us sort of think about where, you know, whether the cancer is really active or whether it's not. This graph is just looking at the rates at which these markers are positive in the two types of cancer. I talked about seminoma, and NSGCT means non-seminoma, so all the other types. And you can see HCG is up in about a small percent of seminoma. AFP is never up in seminoma. And, you know, you can see the numbers here for non-sem. There are a lot of men with seminoma who come in with no markers up. So just the absence of markers doesn't rule out cancer. But if we see them up, that's a helpful sign. Rosie, I didn't put any slides in about what we do when we see somebody with stage one testis cancer. And that's really to do surgery, and what's called an orchiectomy, or removing the testis. That's done through an incision in the inguinal area, which is right in sort of the side of the groin. And literally the surgeon can pull the stalk of the testis and actually pull the testicle out from the scrotum without ever cutting into the scrotum. And he can pull that out and essentially snip it and close the site. That's done as an outpatient procedure. So most men just go home right after that. It's actually not a terribly complicated procedure. The reason they do that, it sounds sort of gross, like they pull it out through the stalk, is that when you cut into the scrotum itself, what you end up doing is sort of cutting into a lot of different planes of tissue right next to the tumor. And there's concern that when you do that, the tumor cells can spill into those broken blood vessels and then disseminate throughout the body. So whenever we see someone who has a testis tumor, and this is really the surgeon's field, not the medical oncologist, it's recommended to do an inguinal surgery, not a scrotal surgery. Because you really prevent a lot of problems. I've seen a few patients who had scrotal, they came in because they had a big swollen testis and it was painful, and the doctor thought, oh, it's a young guy, maybe the testis is just twisted, which happens in children, that's called torsion. And that's where you might do a incision right into the scrotum to fix it. And so he had, for example, a incision right into the scrotum and then presented with disease all over the place and in really unusual places, like in the back of his thigh. He had cancer, which we almost never see, and he had disease all over the chest. And that's because the surgeon didn't sort of recognize that this might be testis cancer in a young man. And the truth is that sometimes a hard diagnosis to make if a patient comes in sort of a ton of pain with a big testis, sometimes, you know, they have to make their decision in the moment, and it's not always easy. So I'm going to talk about what we do. A lot of actually what we talk about in testis cancer is because, you know, most men are pretty attuned to it. They get they feel a lump. They come in, they get their surgery, and then they come to see us afterwards and they say, OK, I had a seminoma or I had a non-seminoma, which, again, are all those other histologies. What should I do? And, you know, as you're going to see, testis cancer is a very sensitive disease. We can treat it with surgery. We can treat it with radiation. We can treat it with chemo. And the challenge has gone from, you know, for men who just have it in their testis, you know, most of them are going to be fine with surveillance, meaning we just need to watch them because a lot of them are already cured of that cancer. But if we give, in certain cases, radiation or chemotherapy, we can increase the chance that they're cured. And so there's always a lot of this decision making, a lot of this thinking about how, you know, What is the patient's tolerance for the cancer coming back? You know, what is their risk sort of aversion? And it gets into like a whole separate field of medicine, which is thinking about sort of how to best counsel a person. Not how do we cure this, but how do we do this with the minimal amount of toxicity? So I'm going to talk just a little bit about literally what we do and why we do it. And I'm going to split this up because they're a little different. You can see surveillance is an option for patients with seminoma and non-sem. Chemo is an option for them as well. For seminoma, we use radiation, and for non-sems, we use surgery. And that's probably more historical than anything else. It's just the way this has developed. So for non-seminoma, which, again, is the right side over here, I said the options are surveillance, surgery, and chemo. And so the reason why we would do surveillance, and I tell this to almost every patient who comes in with stage one non-SEM, is that relapses happen really quick. By 24 months, by 2 years later, almost anybody who's going to relapse has already relapsed. Meaning if they get through the first 2 years, I like bring in the champagne and we celebrate because they're really unlikely to have their cancer recur, you know, from that original tumor. And then even if they do recur, like 99% or more are curable. So if they had their testis removed and a year and a half later they develop a lump in the belly, in the back, we can almost always cure them. Obviously, we have to treat them, chemo, surgery, things like that. But their chance of dying is really low. So it would make sense in sort of the do-no-harm approach to just watch everybody. The arguments against surveillance are, number one, that about 30% of men with non-seminoma eventually relapse. So there's a, you know, there's about a third, 30% risk that they're going to have to deal with this cancer again at some point in their life. This is a picture of somebody who developed a relapse. And this is a chest x-ray where he's essentially standing with his arms above his head facing us. This is his windpipe right in the middle. It's a little hard to see with this pointer. And these are his lungs here. And the lungs should be essentially black because they're just filled with air. And what you see is this like smoke, or they call it popcorn appearance, because it looks literally like popcorn, you know, in the middle of popping. And these are all testicular cancer tumors that recurred. And this is like the 1% of guys who recurred late. He was on surveillance, stopped surveillance about 5 or 6 years, and sort of, you know, thought he was cured. And lo and behold, he developed this, this, you know, relapse in his lungs. And this was fatal. He didn't live very long after this. This was really bad. So this is sort of one thing we take into consideration when we see these patients with stage one disease.
What were his symptoms when he finally came back in?
So what were his symptoms when he relapsed? He came in really short of breath. He had some chest pain, I think, as well, but he really like couldn't walk up a flight of stairs. And he was otherwise healthy. Like, his lungs looked normal in the spaces in between. And had he not been so healthy, probably we would have figured this out earlier. I don't know if that would have affected his course. But so this is concerning, and it's a reason to keep surveilling people even years out. We don't really know what the optimal duration of surveillance is. But
so your slide, it says argument against surveillance, but what you're saying is an argument for surveillance.
I'm giving both sides of the story here. Why might we do surveillance? Why might we not do surveillance?
What does surveillance consist of?
So what does surveillance consist of? That's a really good question. So generally it consists of a CT scan of the abdomen, or sometimes we can do an MRI, chest x-rays, and blood tests, usually about every 3 to 6 months over about 5 years. And so, and actually I think that leads me right into the next point, or maybe the third point. This is what I was getting at before. Young men, you know, think they're invincible. And so a lot of times if I see a young man, like for example, someone who lives on Haight Street and doesn't really have, you know, good social support, and I'm concerned that he's never going to come back to see me, you know, he's just happy that he's done with his surgery, that sort of weighs into our thinking about whether we should give him some more therapy at that moment while we sort of got him in our grasp. This is what gets to that question you just asked, which is, you know, what do we do? Well, so we do scans for these people every 3 to 6 months. But if you add it up, if you read the sort of current guidelines, it's 10 CT scans over 5 years. Each CT scan is about 70 x-rays. So it's somewhere on the order of like 700 to 1,000 x-rays of a young man's body. And I already told you 70% of these men are cured. So we're essentially radiating thousands and thousands of people to prevent these relapses. And there's some tension there between, you know, what's right for an individual versus what's right for the population. One argument is not to do CT scans, just to do MRIs, which have no radiation and are much safer but more expensive. And then that leads us into a whole separate discussion of how we practice medicine. I talked about surveillance. What I'm going to talk about is the other options, right? So if I'm going to see a young man who has stage 1 testis cancer and I think he needs to get treated, what do we do? So there's been a lot of history of doing surgery on these patients, and surgery literally consists of opening up the patient from essentially the bottom of their rib cage down to the belly button or below, essentially moving all the intestines out of the way, and then literally cleaning out all that area between the kidneys, cleaning out all the fat, all the lymph nodes, essentially just leaving behind the blood vessels. And this is sort of a good example of that. This is the what's called the template, this sort of black line here. And so they go in, they try and clean out all the structures in there. The reason that maybe we should do that is that when this surgery is done on young men with stage one testis cancer, we actually find testis cancer in a fair number of these patients. So, you know, even if the lymph nodes aren't big, right, we said they only look like they had stage one disease, about a quarter of them will find some cancer cells up there. Now, were those cancer cells that were going to grow back into a big tumor, or were those cancer cells that were just going to sort of disappear? Was the body going to eat them up? We don't know. But, you know, we do find testis cancer there. And by doing the surgery now, you may avoid giving them, if some of these people were destined to relapse, you avoid giving them chemotherapy. So you might say, okay, let's do surgery, let's sort of take everything out. And then by avoiding chemo in the future, you know, you don't wreck their fertility or you don't hurt their chances of developing infertility. And you avoid all the side effects of chemo that they might be getting later on by just nipping it in the bud now. The real arguments against surgery are that some men will relapse in their chest. Right, they'll have stage one cancer in their testis, and even though I've said that this is the landing zone in the middle of the belly, the cancer cells actually go up to the chest, and it's a small percent of men who relapse up here. But if you've just cleaned out their belly, you haven't really done anything for the cancer cells that are probably hiding in their chest, and all you've done is put them through a surgery that they maybe didn't need. You can see these white structures here on this diagram are nerves. And the nerves essentially come out of the spinal cord and they go all the way down to the pelvis here. And you can see the sort of web of nerves down there. And these nerves are very important for ejaculatory function. So there's like a very set series of muscular contractions that happen when a man ejaculates. And if you cut those nerves, you can really mess that up. And essentially men become unable to ejaculate. They can still orgasm, they can have normal sex, they can have an erection, but they can't get a woman pregnant. And so that can, you know, I just said that, yes, they avoid chemotherapy by doing the surgery, but about 10% of men develop lifelong ejaculatory problems. And probably the biggest argument of all is right here at the bottom of the slide, which is that 70% of men were never going to relapse, and all you've done is just overtreated them. You've just put them through a potentially really serious surgery. They're cutting right around the aorta. They're cutting right around the vena cava. I've seen patients with more complicated tumors in their belly who've gotten surgery where the artery to the kidney has been nicked and they've lost a kidney, or there's been sepsis and they've developed gallbladder problems and they've developed these huge complicated courses. So it's not so clear that everybody should just immediately go to surgery because they have a stage one tumor. And so there's a lot of nuance here. Decision, generally, we don't do surgery right after diagnosis unless there is a lot of teratoma in the initial tumor, because the teratoma, if it goes into the belly, really needs to be surgically removed. It's not very sensitive to chemo. And so if they have a tumor that's all teratoma in their testis and maybe it's big and we don't see anything in the belly and maybe they're someone who's not very likely to follow up, then maybe we'll sort of push them to get adjuvant surgery and we'll get surgery right off the bat. It's not that common that we're operating on men with stage one testis cancer to prevent it from coming back. But there's sort of a whole, you know, calculus that goes into this when a patient comes into the clinic. So this is the most sort of up-to-date thinking on this topic. And I already talked about surveillance. I talked about surgery. I'm going to talk about chemotherapy, because I said those are all options for people with stage one disease. And so chemotherapy is very effective against this tumor. I'll say more about it later. But for stage one patients who get chemotherapy, almost all of them are cured, meaning that they never relapse. And so a group in Sweden and Norway, they were able to sort of call all of the patients who had testis cancer into one or two hospitals in those countries, which is a great sort of benefit of socialized medicine, is everyone can get treated in the same place and in the same way. And they were able to put them on a study. And what they did was they looked at the testis tumor alone. They didn't care what type of tissue was in there as long as there was non-SEM, germ cell tumor. And they said, if you have cancer cells in the blood vessels in the testis tumor, you're at higher risk, just by logic, of those cancer cells having already spread out of the testis. So literally when they looked at the tumor, they looked at the blood vessels in the tumor. And if there were cancer cells sitting in a blood vessel, they got put into this sort of column of high risk. And if there were no cancer cells in the blood vessels, if there were tumor in the testis, but the blood cells, blood vessels themselves were clear, they were considered low risk. And what they then said was everybody can get a choice of getting chemo or not getting chemo. And what they saw was that if patients were low risk here in the yellow line, meaning the cancer wasn't in the blood vessels, and they didn't get any chemo, at 10 years later, you can see that 86% of them were still cancer-free. So that means that for a man who has no cancer cells in the blood vessels at the time of their testis being removed, they're, you know, have an 86% chance that they're done with this cancer, they're cured of it. If the patients elected to get chemotherapy, even though they were low risk, you know, there was a benefit, meaning that, you know, there was about a 13% or 14% of patients by getting chemotherapy early prevented it from relapsing. And I should say the chemotherapy was just one cycle of chemo as opposed to three or four cycles, which they would get later on. So they got a little dose of chemo and it helped them, you know, it prevented some men from relapsing. If you look on this side, the difference is way more dramatic. And in the yellow line here are the men who had cancer cells in their blood vessels at the time of surgery, but said, no, I don't want chemotherapy, forget it. And there aren't that many of the men in this slide. It's only about 20 men, because most men, you know, sort of rationally would want to prevent the cancer from coming back. But you can see that if men were high risk and didn't get chemotherapy, like almost half of them relapsed over the course of 10 years. And you can see they relapsed really quick, right? Within 2 years, everyone who's going to relapse did, and then the line was just very kind of static after that. So if I see a man who comes in and they have cancer in their testis and it's in those blood vessels in the testis, I tell them straight up, you have at least a 50% chance or close to 50% chance of this cancer coming back. Now, in this study, if they treated them with one cycle, which is the black line, or two cycles, which is the blue line, there was this tremendous gain in their sort of risk of the cancer coming back, meaning that even just one cycle of chemo for these guys really prevented almost everybody from relapsing, which you can see here. If you gave two cycles, 100% of people were cured of the disease. And so when I see someone who comes in with high-risk disease, I almost always counsel them to get at least one cycle, because there's this clear benefit for giving chemotherapy for those patients. And if you just think about it, you've saved 50% of these men from getting three or four cycles of chemo later on by just giving them each one. On the other hand, if I see someone like this, you know, I tell them straight off, you know, you have an almost 90% chance of being cured already. Do you want to get a cycle of chemotherapy to bring that up by, you know, 10%? And that's where, again, it goes back to this sort of how do you define risk and how do you counsel somebody about that? And that's a whole, like, I think, really interesting part of medicine. But in general, I try and discourage people from getting chemo for this unless they have a real, real reason why they wouldn't want to get chemo later on if they relapsed. And, you know, there are reasons that you might want to, that we might want to give chemotherapy to these people. So these are the take-home points for stage one disease. Very curable no matter what we do. You can consider adjuvant treatment if there's cancer cells in those blood vessels, or if you think the patients aren't going to show up, or that there's going to be some kind of problem getting them in clinic. If you're concerned about doing scans on them for years and years, and you want to avoid that, that's a very difficult decision to make, and it's hard to counsel people about that. And if they're, you know, if they're unable to tolerate more aggressive therapy later on, like, for example, if they have bad HIV, which fortunately we don't see very much anymore, or if they are really concerned about their fertility later on, you might want to treat them up front. But you can see how sort of nuanced these decisions are. And even though we have all this data, sometimes it's a very challenging decision for these young men to make. I'm going to talk briefly about the seminoma patients. It's a little different, but not terribly. Seminoma is very sensitive to radiation therapy, unlike non-SEMs, which really aren't that sensitive. So radiation can very potently kill seminoma. This is a paper from 1930, right? So it's amazing that this even exists online. But you can pull papers from, you know, 1930 where they looked at the clinical course and reaction to irradiation in testicular neoplasm. So as early as 1930, I mean, radium, which is the source of radiation, was only discovered like 30 years before this. And they were already treating and curing men with testis cancer in their abdomen. And so this is how radiation is given today. Before, they used to literally cut the patient open and pour the radiation, like a solution or pellets, into the person's body and then close them up and then like, you know, pull it out. It was really, you know, not, it was a little crude. Today, obviously, we give most of it externally, you know, in this machine. This is what the radiation oncologists do, which is they take an X-ray of the patient. They sort of draw out the field they want to treat, which is here in blue. And then they draw out the stuff they want to protect, which are the kidneys here in orange. And basically, the machine knows, and they can do this in three dimensions. So they can plan to give a certain dose of radiation to a certain field, and the machine essentially moves around the patient. The table moves around, and they can like sort of essentially give a three-dimensional dose of radiation by just shooting the beams in such, in, you know, in such the right way. And so, you know, what they really do is they cover. This is sort of the base of the rib cage right here, or the front of the rib cage, the breastbone, and they sort of go all the way down to the beginning of the pelvis, which is this landing zone for testis cancer. And so radiation is an option for these patients. Seminoma is a little easier in terms of the counseling because about 80% of men who have seminoma are fine with surveillance. They're in this bottom line here. They never relapse. There's about 20% of men who do relapse. If we give them RT or radiation therapy, we can prevent them from relapsing almost to 100%. It's like 90+%. We can also get that same effect by giving them chemotherapy. That was a recent study that showed that if you give just one dose, one very high dose of chemo, you can prevent these people from relapsing. And so that same discussion happens for these stage one seminoma patients, except we really just don't talk about much about surgery because the disease is so sensitive to radiation therapy. So for seminoma, 80% of people never relapse. Adjuvant radiation or chemotherapy are reasonable, but just like the non-sems, really may not be necessary at all. We don't really have the same risk-adapted approaches. We don't have that technique of looking in the blood vessels in the original tumor and seeing if the cancer is there and then deciding who gets what. It's just not been validated for reasons that I don't completely understand, or I don't think we really know, I should say. So we need better sort of risk-adapted approaches. You know, the size of the tumor by itself doesn't tell us whether or not we should treat somebody. The real take-home is that anybody who's reliable should probably go on surveillance unless they have a real sort of pressing need to get more treatment. I did recently just see a patient who had like a significant fear of the hospital and of needles. And he had a very large tumor, a very large seminoma. And I sort of walked him through this. And he said, I'd rather get one dose of chemotherapy up here, like get one needle in my arm once and be done with it, than take a 20% chance that I'm going to have to get weeks and weeks of chemotherapy in the future. And he also had a little baby at home. And so we gave him one dose of chemo, and it's now 3 years later, and he hasn't relapsed. And he's sort of happy with that decision. But, you know, it's very nuanced. So in the last few minutes, I'm just going to talk about more advanced disease. This, again, is the landing zone for testis cancer. All this fluffy stuff here around the aorta, but that's all testis cancer. So that's called stage 2 disease. So stage 2 disease can be treated in somewhat of a similar way to what we've been talking about, which is for seminomas, we can radiate them. For non-sems, we can do surgery. The outcomes are pretty similar. Chemotherapy is also okay for these small tumors in the belly. The advantage of chemo is that it goes all over the body. So if the cancer cells are in the chest, then we can kill the cancer cells in the chest. For the same reasons we might do surgery that I talked about already, for the stage 1 patients, sometimes we'll do that for the stage 2 patients if there's a lot of teratoma, which is not sensitive to chemo. And generally for most seminomas, we'll radiate them straight up because it's well tolerated and it's very effective. If patients come in with bulky tumors in their belly, or if the tumor spread up into the chest, or it's in the liver, or anywhere else in the body, then they have to get chemo. Because bulky tumors just they don't tend to be cured with radiation or with surgery. They just tend to relapse. You know, you can imagine because the size sort of...
Is it different chemo for different
kinds of cancer? So is chemo different for the different kinds of cancer? Interestingly, not. So the same chemo that works for non-seminoma also works for seminoma. So even though there's this discordance between surgery and radiation in terms of seminoma, non-sem, the chemo is very similar. And that actually makes my job a lot easier because it's one type of chemo that we talk about. I'm going to talk about that, I think, in a slide or two. The challenge always is when patients come in with large tumors is we can give them chemo. I remember I told you teratoma is not very sensitive to chemotherapy. What I didn't tell you is that seminoma, sometimes you can kill the seminoma, but it'll leave behind a humongous scar. Sometimes it's very difficult to know, is that scar, is that tumor left behind, is that viable cancer, or is that just scar? And there's some techniques we have to distinguish one from the other. But one of the other major consults, the reason why people come to us as a center of excellence, is that we have a lot of expertise in dealing with what we call post-chemotherapy masses, meaning post-chemotherapy residual tumors. And so this, for example, is someone who had cancer in the chest. This was before chemotherapy. They had a very big tumor. This was a non-seminoma. And then this is after chemotherapy. And you can see it really shrank. You know, the chemo did a good job in shrinking this tumor. And there's actually, you know, it's probably reduced by more than half. But this is still probably 5 or 6 centimeters big. And what we can't tell is there cancer in there? Is it scar? Is it teratoma? It's really sometimes a challenge. And so these are sort of what we're always concerned about. Obviously, we're not really concerned about scar because it can just stay there. It'll shrink over time. But if there's still viable cancer cells in there that have somehow not been killed by the chemo, or if teratoma is left behind, then we have to think about removing it. And so we have very sort of clear protocols that if the cancer is above a certain size, it automatically comes out. Sometimes for seminomas, we'll do something called a PET scan, which measures how active metabolically the tumor is. And if it's very active, then it comes out. The big challenge with some of these residual masses is after chemo is given, the cancers sort of become like concrete. And seminoma does this a lot, where the surgeons go in there and they have to like chip it away, like they're drilling concrete out of someone's abdomen. And so we really want to be careful about who we send for surgery, because those are men who are really high risk of developing ejaculatory dysfunction, you know, and other kind of complications of surgery when they're chipping away at the stuff next to the major blood vessels in the body. So this is always a challenging thing to think about. Sometimes we have to get a urologist to take away the belly tumor, sometimes a thoracic surgeon to do the chest, have to figure out which one comes first. It can be very challenging in people with more advanced disease. So this is the reason, I probably should have put this slide a little earlier. This is teratoma, and this is why we remove it. So again, this is very similar to that picture I showed you before, where you see cartilage on the left here, and this is, again, I think respiratory lining. And this is all within a tumor in a man's abdomen, right? And so by itself, this is not that concerning. The X-ray is really fascinating. It's a picture of the pelvis, so this is sort of like the inside of the pelvis, and around it are the bones of the pelvis. And you see this weird structure here, right? And you can almost make out it's got little ridges like a tooth. And so this is literally a teratoma that formed that has developed into like little teeth. And when they took it out, it looked like there were teeth in this structure. And so you can see the little ridges of like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 teeth in there. So that's actually, it's fascinating. We call it literally a fascinoma, right? Because it's like you never see that stuff. But by itself, it's not that bad, right? Unless this thing were to like obstruct the kidney or obstruct the spine, it wouldn't be that bad. The challenge is that this tumor is like totally dysregulated. It's kind of growing in all these different ways and doing all these different types of tissue are growing. And these tissues within the tumor can themselves turn into other types of cancer. And we call that transforming. And so I've seen a case where a patient had a teratoma that was left behind, and like 9 years later, he developed colon cancer. But his colon was totally clean. And the colon cancer literally arose out of colonic like lining of this teratoma that became unstable itself and turned into cancer. And so very frequently, we'll see sarcomas come out of this, like adenocarcinomas, all these other types of, you know, basically incurable cancers. And so beyond just, you know, removing the mass, there's also this late risk of it developing into something really bad. So we try and get these out. The risk of that stuff happening for really small teratomas is really, really low. So if we see a little 1 centimeter residual mass or a 5 millimeter residual mass, we tend to leave it alone. There's a lot of debate in the field about whether even those should come out because of this late risk. So you can imagine this is a real challenge in terms of how to counsel people, especially if they've already been through 3 or 4 cycles of chemo and they feel like they're, you know, they've already been through the ringer. To put them through a big surgery can be a real challenge. This, again, is what we find at tumor when we do the resection, usually scar, sometimes teratoma, and sometimes residual germ cell tumor, actually a live cancer. This is the last few slides. This is the same picture of teratoma. I'm not going to go through this in too much detail, but the retroperitoneum actually looked okay here. There were some small little lymph nodes back here. The patient got chemo, and they all vanished, and this was in 1998. By 2001, he had developed a lump here, and no one biopsied it. They just said, oh, he's got recurrent germ cell tumor, right, because he had cancer there. It shrunk. Oh, it grew back. So they gave him chemotherapy for testis cancer, and the tumor basically barely changed in size. And so they said, okay, let's take a biopsy of this. And it was a totally different type of cancer. It was a sarcoma. And presumably there was some little amount of testis of a teratoma here that had transformed into what's very likely an incurable cancer. So this is a real challenge. Fortunately, this is pretty rare. We see maybe one or two people like this a year. Obviously when it happens, it's a disaster because it usually happens to, you know, a young man. So the last few minutes, I'm just going to talk about chemo. You know, I talked a little bit about chemo last week. This is the model of the curable malignancy. So this drug platinum I brought up last week is literally a heavy metal. We think it's precious. We make jewelry out of it. But if you look in the periodic table, it's like mercury and it's like lead. It's bad for the body. And it's really, really toxic to testis cancer. Like the cancer cells are growing so fast, when they take this up, they become totally sort of poisoned and they basically die. And so if you look, we had about a year ago, we had Larry Einhorn, who is like considered sort of the father of this field, come and talk to us. And he did the very first phase one study of cisplatin in 1975. And he showed this great graph. I've been trying to find it, but I can't. Of the cure rates for testis cancer. And it's like 40% of men were cured in 1971, 2, 3. And then 1974 hits, and it goes up to like 80% of men. And then it's like 80% from there on. And it's this one drug that came into clinical use that really just propelled, you know, oncology forward and really saved thousands of men's lives. And over the next 20 years or so, they've been working, or we've been working at refining this. And so by adding these three drugs together, platinum, a drug called etoposide, and a very old drug called bleomycin, we can cure on the order of 90%+ of men who have widespread testis cancer. These drugs are given all three at the same time, basically. Usually most men come in every 3 weeks. They'll come in, for example, every day for the first week to an outpatient clinic. They'll get an IV put in their arm. Chemo will be given over a few hours. It goes all over their body and they go home. And they come back Tuesday, they come back Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then they're done for that cycle. And then the cycle repeats 3 weeks later. And so they'll do essentially three or four cycles of chemotherapy. This is tough. You know, this is three drugs of chemotherapy are tough for anyone. You know, young men tend to be a little more resilient than, you know, like older men with prostate cancer, but it's still tough. And it causes a lot of problems. The etoposide causes hair loss in almost everybody. Usually the eyebrows go too. The cisplatin causes nausea and kidney problems. The bleomycin can cause lung problems. And so if we see smokers, we don't give them bleomycin. We just give them an extra cycle of, we just give them EMP and we give them an extra cycle of that. And then they can get neuropathy or nerve damage. So they go numb in their fingertips. And that can be lifelong. And then the etoposide, if you give enough etoposide to anybody, they'll develop leukemia because it just damages cells all over the place anyway. So it's about like less than 1% of men who get testis cancer chemotherapy full dose will develop leukemia. We see maybe one every 2 or 3 years, and it's just a tragedy when it happens because usually they're cured of testis cancer, but then they develop an incurable leukemia, and that's usually fatal really quick. So it's another reason why we always have pause, especially early on when a lot of men are maybe cured with stage one disease. It's rather the reason why I try not to give these men chemo, because even though it's a rare problem, these are like generally lifelong. You know, the kidney and lung problems can be lifelong. The nerve damage can be lifelong. The secondary cancers, you know, are such a huge problem that we have to be really thoughtful about who we treat and who we you know, just observe. This is an example of, we don't see it very much because we're smart about who we give bleomycin to, but this is a picture of the lungs. Now, the lungs should normally be basically black with just some white dots in there. And the white dots are blood vessels. For example, this is a little blood vessel over here. And what you see is all this sort of streaky, hazy stuff, which is essentially scarring in the lung. This is like what a Hiroshima survivor looks like, when their lungs have just been fully irradiated and it's become scarred, and essentially the air is not able to pass, the lungs aren't able to expand right. And this is a side effect of this drug, bleomycin. Bleo will kill testis cancer cells, but it'll also really damage lung cells in about 10% of men. And so we're always really attuned to that. So if a man's on bleomycin and gets a cough, we sort of hold on, we stop, do an x-ray, maybe do a CT scan. There's a lot of debate about how to manage it. But when it happens, it's really bad. Most men can recover, but about 1% will have serious toxicity. And we've had, I think, one or two fatalities in the time I've been here at UCSF from patients who got this and it was unrecognized. So fortunately, we don't use this drug very much. But you know, when we do, we have to be really attuned to it. We know a little bit about advanced disease that if, what we're going to talk about in the last, I think, two or three slides is relapse disease. So most men, I said, are cured with chemotherapy. If they're not cured, say that they get chemo and then 3 months later or 6 months later, those blood markers I told you about go up, or we do another scan after chemo's finished and we see a new tumor arises, we can give more chemotherapy, and there's a number of other regimens. I'm not really going to talk about them, that sort of use slightly newer types of chemo. But we know very, very quickly sort of who's going to do well and who's not. And basically, men who relapse within 6 months of getting their first course of chemotherapy are in a lot of trouble. There are very few men, it's maybe less than 10% of men, maybe less than 5 even, who never fully respond to chemo. Almost everybody fully responds, somewhat in that number. But if patients relapse quick, that's a really bad sign, because it says the cancer is, like, you know, much more aggressive. Interestingly, if they relapse late, like the patient I showed you had the popcorn in the lungs, that's also a really bad sign. And I don't think anyone really understands what the biology of that is, because it's one of the few cancers where late relapse is really a poor sign. For example, in kidney cancer, late relapses are actually a good thing. They're very curable. But late relapse in testis cancer is a very poor prognostic sign. Non-seminomas tend to do a little worse than seminomas. Patients who develop cancer, I didn't really talk about this. I've said everybody develops cancer in their testis. There's a small percent of men whose germ cells are stuck behind in their abdomen or even in their chest. Those germ cells from way back when we were an embryo reside there and can turn into cancer. Again, it's very rare that patients develop a primary germ cell tumor here or primary germ cell tumor in the chest, but it does happen. Those men are in a lot more trouble, partly because probably the biology is a little worse for reasons we don't clearly understand, but also because the location in the chest is really bad. These tumors tend to wrap around blood vessels, they wrap around the heart, and it's not like something in the belly that can just be scooped out by a surgeon once chemotherapy is done. If it's really sort of trapped in the chest, it may be really hard to ever remove. And then obviously people who have disease in the actual organs, in the viscera or in their brain, do much worse in general, just because the disease is much more spread. Treating brain metastases and testicular cancer really can be a challenge, like it is for just about every other kind of cancer, because there's only so much tissue that you can damage in the brain before you start causing really serious problems. So what do we do? Most times we give them more chemo. Again, there's other agents. I don't think they're that important to talk about today, but they cause very similar side effects. They cause immune suppression, hair loss, all that kind of stuff. There's a risk of serious infections and stuff like that. There are some experimental approaches. You know, the truth is that only 500 men die a year of testis cancer. And so the drive for drug companies is not as strong as it is for a disease like pancreas cancer, where 40,000 people die every year, to develop new therapies. There are some approaches. There are some studies of new agents. What's probably the most sort of researched area right now, or area under investigation, is what's called high-dose chemotherapy and stem cell rescue. So for any of you who are familiar with leukemia or with lymphoma, this is a way that we very commonly treat leukemia and lymphoma, which are can be very aggressive diseases of the bone marrow or of the blood itself. And the idea behind this is that when patients relapse, I said you can give them more chemo, right? But not everybody is cured with more chemo. And maybe what it is that we just need to give them a really, really high dose of chemo. Like I already said, sometimes these tumors are like concrete. Maybe you need a 5 times the dose of chemo to penetrate that concrete and kill every last cancer cell. And so the idea of high dose chemotherapy is, well, you know, we can give anybody, you know, 10 times the normal dose of chemo, like that'll go in fine, but it'll just damage the patient too much. You know, it'll be a lethal dose of chemotherapy. And the reason why these super high doses of chemo are lethal is because they kill the bone marrow. They kill all the blood cells and all the immune system, and it just wipes it out. And patients don't live very long without an immune system. So the idea behind stem cell rescue is that the very first thing that happens to a patient is they get either bone marrow literally taken out of their pelvis, or they can do a procedure where they take blood and run it through a machine and suck out the stem cells or preserve the stem cells. Those stem cells get frozen. I have a graphic on the next page. And then the patients get these super high doses of chemo. And we know that it's going to wipe out their immune system. So they get admitted to the hospital for a month, sometimes for 2 months. And we sort of watch their counts go down to zero. Almost everybody needs blood transfusions, platelet transfusions, you know, and they're at super high risk for infections because their immune systems are gone. And then after a few days, you can rescue the patient literally by either giving their bone marrow back to them, which is not commonly done, but more by taking these stem cells, thawing them, and literally just hanging a little bag into an IV. And those stem cells will basically circulate in the body. They somehow know to go back to where they came from, and they'll start making normal blood cells. And so that takes about 2 or 3 weeks. And so the patient will go from having a normal immune system to having no immune system back to having their own normal immune system. And you've managed to give this super high dose of chemo. Generally, we do 2 of these. So we'll do that's considered 1 transplant. We call it transplant. It's not someone else's immune system. It's not like we're taking a donor or someone who's matched to the patient, but we're taking the patient's own immune system. The reason we don't use somebody else's immune system is because the rates of complications are much higher when you take someone else's immune system. On the order of about 20% of patients die when that procedure is done. And so that has not really been shown to be effective in testis cancer. So this is sort of the schematic of what happens. It's pretty straightforward. The blood is collected. It's processed. It's sort of frozen. Cryopreserved means frozen. The chemotherapy down here is given to the patient, and then the blood is infused back into the patient and sort of hones to the right area. So this is the outcome. So how does that affect patients with advanced testis cancer? And basically, these are 5 graphs of patients who are sort of stratified by good risk to poor risk based on some of the stuff I told you. Like, did they relapse quickly or did they relapse, a year or two later? And if basically across the board, it looks in yellow like patients who get transplants do better than patients who get in blue the conventional chemotherapy. So if you got a transplant, you are more likely to do better. And obviously, patients who are good risk do better than patients who are poor risk down here, where almost all of them are dying and just a very small percent of patients are surviving with the high-dose transplant. This study itself has been somewhat criticized because it's retrospective, meaning they looked at people who got the transplants and they said, oh, if you got a transplant, you did better. But maybe the people who got transplants were like inherently a little healthier than people who didn't get transplants. So there's in the works is a prospective study where we're going to take 1,000 men and split them up. Half of them are going to get in blue standard chemotherapy for salvage or for rescue, and the other half are going to get the transplant. And we're going to see at the end of the day, which group does better. And that'll really answer this question of how valuable is this. There have been a number of studies done already, but they haven't quite answered the question. Like I said, we give 2 of these. Usually is better than 1, but many more studies are needed. So just the last slide. You know, testis cancer is rare in the population, but it's common in young men. Surveillance, I think, is the most appropriate option for almost all the stage 1 patients with all these caveats. And it's, again, I actually like seeing these patients because it's really like a different story each time, and the challenges are always different with each patient. Patients with stage 2 disease can get surgery, radiation, chemo. There's all these nuances, which I talked about. We should always think about removing the post-chemotherapy tumors, again, with all these caveats that I've talked about. And then relapse disease, we're still learning a lot about the high-dose therapy. And so probably in the next, 3 to 5 years, we'll have an answer, hopefully, on this question, which, you know, will sort of help us kind of move forward. Okay. Well, thanks for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.